So, hey, thank you for being here again, Alon.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Very cool.
And for jumping on multiple interviews and a mini design session with Claire. So, Alon Sylvan is founder, CEO, head of Sylvan Labs. Mm-hmm. And we actually only met, I guess, like a month ago or so. So I'd been learning about more what you do. I would love to, I think, just jump straight in and be like, what are you working on? I know you're out of the space today. What are you working on out of the space, if you can talk about it?
A couple different things. With the end of the year, I have a lot of planning to do when it comes to, you know, getting a good picture of how we're going to do this year, and so mm-hmm. we can set the stage for next year. So that applies to the company, but it also applies to my clients. Mm-hmm. My clients are also going through a lot of those same transition moments. So it's a bit of, introspection, taking a step back. And so literally right now I was going through things like our financial data over mm-hmm. the year, and thinking about one or two of my senior clients who have kind of big questions looming. As a reminder, what we do is we help companies develop and think about their brands and their products when it comes to experiences and design and needs and insights, all of that. We have one big client now who's thinking about 2019 and they want to launch a lot of big things. And so how do we do that?
At one time, kind of in the office you're in, how many projects, active projects, are you balancing at one time?
We have, I'd say, probably around 12 to 15 projects on average, sometimes more than that, sometimes less than mm-hmm. that. We have about 35 people that work with me, mostly strategists by far. Mm-hmm. So people who work in kind of insight and business. And then we have a few designers in addition to that.
Cool. And then obviously, besides, maybe not obviously, because we haven't really talked about it yet, but besides the labs, you're also an investor in a number of companies. You're on the board of a couple things. Do you find yourself always kind of torn between multiple different endeavors, or is your most of your focus able to stick with the Sylvan Labs kind of endeavor?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because the company is my focus, and then as part of that, I'm involved in a lot of different things. I'm invested in a couple of things and do participate in a couple of boards, but it's all through the idea of growing and making Sylvan Labs stronger and better. Mm-hmm. So it does feel quite focused. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I'm not alone. We have a lot of people that I work with, and there are about five or so people that are also really kind of integral to the growth of the company that lead different aspects of what we do. And while my name's on the door, the egomaniac that I am, but the day's on the door. But, because we have a really tight leadership structure, we can put the focus in things the way they deserve.
That's nice.
On a personal level, there's some things that are more interesting to me than others, and those are the things I kind of am drawn to.
Sure. Are you as a strategy firm or a strategy studio? Mm-hmm. I can imagine your purview is probably pretty wide, the kind of things you can get yourself into, let alone the kind of brands you work with. Mm-hmm. I can imagine a lot of the projects and clients you're working on now you can't really talk about, but is there a recent project that you can walk me through the steps of what the ask was when the client first talked to you guys and what the kind of final product or deliverable or series of things you could put out was, just to see that trajectory of transformation and the kind of things that you guys bring mm-hmm. when they ask you?
Yeah, I mean, right now, as of this very moment, we're working on a bunch of different things. We're working with Waze, which is owned by Google, mm-hmm. the app, thinking about what is that offering and what should that brand stand for. We're doing that work with Spotify, same work. We're also working with BlackRock, the huge asset management firm, thinking about what their brand means and how the experience actually delivers mm-hmm. on some of those, the purpose that it wants to stand for. We're doing a lot of work with General Motors and thinking about the future of the driving experience, the connected car. But to give you a little bit more tangible experience, we're doing a lot of work with the NBA recently. The WNBA is a league owned by the broader NBA that's kind of revolutionary, the idea of a women's league, professional league in this country. Whose mission is to inspire and empower women. It's really all about uplifting women in society and in sport. But yet the experience in the arenas or on television somehow aren't producing the results that they want. Mm. Especially if you put it relative to the MNBA, the men's NBA, that makes a ton of money. It's a $9 billion industry or $9 billion business. The WNBA is far behind. So they came to us with that question of how can we reinvent the league and rethink the business of the league so that it can continue, it can grow, it can actually do well. So what we did is we did a lot of research with players and with execs and with fans to get a sense of what they want from the WNBA and to get a better picture of how they might make more money. And then we developed a bunch of business ideas or models that we recommended that could help generate more revenue for them. And we came up with a few of them. They've identified one that they want to move forward with. And we're in the middle of working with them now to change the league. So it's to really tap into what makes the WNBA unique and different from the men's league. Because my personal belief is that the WNBA is just a sort of a imitation of the men's league. And
you mean how it's presented?
I mean, every aspect of it, like the naming constructs, the logos, the uniforms, the television rights, even the gameplay, that, you know, the shot clock and all those things. But if you were to reinvent the league for today, truly, if you were to reinvent a women's basketball league for today, I think you'd go about it differently, especially in this moment now where that we're in culturally when it comes to women and power and so on.
So with that example, I mean, the ask is huge. Mm-hmm. And actually, I can imagine from both getting the larger scale in terms of moving into what does it even mean to have a women's NBA or sports league, certainly in the time we're in now, and even just in general, philosophically, kind of like the impact of that all the way down to, like you said, the logo of it, the naming convention, the shot clock conventions. The scale and scope is so broad. Are you guys involved with every aspect of that?
No. We developed the kind of a high level strategic solve for it that you could use to kind of trigger changes on a more tangible or literal level. So we're not kind of rewriting the in arena experience, but we're kind of developing a sense of what you want that experience to achieve, or what you want the takeaway to be, that we can then hand to people who really know what they're talking about, and they could develop a strategy and a plan for that. Our client work is most successful when we're involved in the development of things, so that the integrity of the strategy is kind of retained throughout, you know? But it takes, you're right, like our job requires like a very, like a deep respect for crafts that are different than ours. But we have to know enough to be dangerous, but not enough to actually execute it. And you know, to do the job well, you bring in people who know what they're doing and offer a lot of insight. But yeah, a part of our work is very general. So we do take a kind of a bigger look at things and help clients make decisions. Some of our projects are very, very big questions. Like General Motors is like, you know, what is the driverless car going to mean for people? You know, and others are very tangible. You know, we want to create a flavor extension of this one product, and what flavor should it be? And it, you know, so our projects vary in that way a lot.
Just because this is probably one minor, or maybe not minor, like a very small aspect of the WNBA project. Let's say we were talking about the logo design. Yeah. I was like, what do I understand of this? Yeah. So you, for example, Savan, would not be the ones to design the logo itself, but you kind of set the parameters for what conceptually or what the logo needs to achieve.
Right. Logo design isn't the best example because we are doing more and more of that.
Sure.
We are doing more sort of the impact of our work. If I was to distill our work, I would say it's three different parts. It's like truth, possibility, and impact.
Okay.
The truth is like, what is the reality for clients today? What are they facing? In the case of the WNBA, they're facing you know, a brand that's under distress. You know, not the greatest numbers in terms of attendance and viewership and all that. And so we help them capture that truth in a visceral way. And then possibility is really thinking strategically about where they can go. In the case of the WNBA, it's things like, you know, are there other business models that they can learn from? Are there other leagues around the world that we can replicate? Are there other ways to integrate players into the fundamentals of the business? And so that's a bit of the possibilities piece. And then impact is, you know, really bring kind of what you're alluding to is like really bringing the strategy to life. Mm-hmm. So how should the logo look? What should the arena experience be? When it comes to something like the logo, that's something we would be able to do.
Got it.
But you know, there are other bits to it, like you know, like again, the in arena experience, right? So right now, a men's basketball game, you know, you get tickets, you sit and you watch men play basketball. But there are other sort of experiences that you could have in an arena, right? There are social experiences. Mm-hmm. You could have events around events. You can bring out the players more. You know, why does it need to be bleacher seating? Maybe there's completely different seating that you can think about, or you know, how to use halftime, you know, or all of those little details are parts that we would inform and then kind of brief in an expert on it. You know, is it a experiential agency or a Live Nation or something that can help think about the potential of the impact there? So our business is really truth and possibility and a little bit more impact. We're kind of growing more into the impact part through design.
Has that, I mean, especially with the kind of tag of strategy, the in some ways because you're always being asked to imagine what the future might look like, what the possibility might look like, but because I can imagine, like the example you described of the in arena experience, even that alone, it seems like the, how do I put it, like again, the breadth of the things that you can bring to the table is so amazingly and excitingly broad and amorphous from the beginning. Mm-hmm. In a really exciting way. Has, unlike for example architecture, like you may not know what the building's going to look like, but you'll have a building there. You know, right, exactly, yeah, what sort of, yeah, that thing will be. As Savannah's grown, have you found that you guys get more specific or more focused / limited with the kind of offerings or ways you approach things, or has she actually grown and gotten even broader and wider with how you?
Well, I think there are two ways to look at it. I think from the outside looking in, if you saw what you see, which is we work across a number of industries, you know, fashion and sports and media and technology. And then you look at all the things we're doing within that. We're developing products and businesses, and we have our own products and our own, you know, writing books and we're creating documentaries. From the outside, it looks like it's a very varied assortment of work. But from the inside, there's always like a very clear anchor to why we do what we do. In the case of the WNBA, the anchor was its mission. Its mission is to inspire and empower women. That was sort of the root of it. You know, our we always have an anchor in everything we do, so it does feel very single-minded. You know, sometimes it's about needs on the part of consumers or something that's happening in business. For us at Sylvain Labs, our anchor for everything we do is really to leverage the might of corporations for the greater good. So how can you take the power of a BlackRock and really impact the world more positively and find some virtue in some of that scale? I think from the outside, it's a mess. It's kind of speaks to who I am, right? So from the outside, it's a mess and a lot of things going on and like what, there's no single mind, like what does it all mean? How does it come together? But from the inside out, it feels very purposeful and I'm at peace with that variety, you know?
Before starting your own shop, were you working at another strategy firm?
Yeah, I was working at a very similar company, that's where I learned a bit about this work. I was a managing director of a company called Red Scout, and it did similar work, and I got a sense of, you know, how do you hire strategists? Mm-hmm. What is strategy? How do you sell it in? How is it different than a design studio or a management consulting company or an advertising agency? And it's really this idea of like this type of consulting that I do is a very niche type of management consulting that didn't exist 10 or 15 years ago. So I learned a lot about it then. I started my company 9 years ago. So we've been doing it a while now.
Did you always know that you wanted to start your own company at some point?
I think so. I think like a lot of people, I think, first of all, I think everybody sort of has an instinct to want to start their own gem. You know, there are very few people who are like, I just want to phone it in. And I think we all have that sort of that fantasy. And so, yeah, I always had it. You know, what I never really understood was like how you know, what should it be and how can it tap into what I'm inherently good at when I didn't really know what I'm good at. Mm-hmm. I still don't really know what my single thing is. But once I figured out that I can, that I was good at this one thing and that there was a demand in the world and that I could package it in a certain way, that's sort of when I was like, yeah, this is the time to start.
You said 9 years ago you started it?
Yeah.
So that was that, is that, there's a, the moment after a recession actually seemed like a really fertile time. I mean, a lot of people started, including myself, like started companies just because you're like, we have nothing else to do.
Right.
Yeah. And you have nothing to lose because you have zero money. Did that play into that jump from now, okay, I'm going to take the leap to start my own thing? Or it just there was something else, another signal that made the timing right?
Well, no, I was lucky enough to always have work during that time. But I can relate to what you're talking about because I went through some kind of shitty moments at work. And, you know, it's funny. I went to Big Island in Hawaii recently. Have you ever been there?
Not to Big Island, no. Just Oahu.
Oahu, yeah. Which is also similar to what I'm getting at. Like Big Island, there was an active volcano when I was there over the summer. And I learned a lot about volcanoes. And so volcanoes, the lava ravishes the land. It's like savage, just completely strips it of all the nature. And, you know, people die and farmland gets destroyed. But what's amazing about volcanoes is that it actually creates this fertile soil so that new things can grow. And actually, volcanoes, the surrounding areas of volcanoes are the most fertile in the world. And, you know, it's like something like 1% of the Earth's surface is volcanoes, but it can sustain 10% of the world's population. And that's kind of how I look at the recession and I look at the intensity that I went through in 2010 when it came to work. It was like, it was a fucking volcano. It was intense. Mm-hmm. Everything was destroyed. But to your point, it sort of set the fertile ground to start something new that was super lush and is continuing to grow today. So yeah, I needed to have that sort of violent beginning to kind of get to...
Was it a straight cut leaving... I'm sorry, what was the company called?
Red Scout.
Red Scout? Was it like, I'm done here, I'm starting something?
It was actually worse than that because, I, like all of us, I was thinking about starting my own thing well before I left Red Scout, and I had already started kind of planting seeds and stuff. So by the time the day I left Red Scout, I already had...
straight to work again?
Yeah, I mean, it was already... I had people working office space, and which... You know, I wouldn't recommend for ethical reasons. It's not, you know, you have a job, you stick to your job. But in my case, it was seamless, and I've been super busy ever since.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. How do you get into strategy? Like, how does, can I ask you, what did you study?
I have a MBA, and I have a master's in international affairs.
Okay.
But before that, I was an undergrad. And I went to a liberal arts college and studied political science and, you know, all sorts of touchy-feely things that are hard to quantify today. Mm-hmm. But I would say that, to answer your question, this kind of liberal arts education was a foundation for the beginnings of me getting into strategy. Most people get into it that way, really thinking about society and, you know, maybe they have some business experience. But the strategist, the way I see it, is a combination of understanding people, understanding business, and understanding the potential of creativity kind of all coming together. And people come from a lot of different places. So some people are like me, who might have some educational experience that kind of drives them in this direction. Other people are maybe designers who want to apply their thinking on a more academic way or something. You have business people who feel like they're too creative to work in Wall Street. So it kind of it brings a lot of different people together, which can kind of makes it cool sometimes.
Well, I mean, because what I really both like, and I always have my a hard time wrapping my head around strategy in general, because it does seem like it can apply to virtually anything. Mm-hmm. The outcomes can be virtually anything.
Right.
Like there's a lot of really amazing open-endedness to it. And maybe there are now, but like you said, maybe this kind of profession didn't exist a decade ago or 15 years ago quite as it is now.
Right. There's the profession and then there's strategy, right? So the profession is this niche type of consulting that only existed relatively recently. But strategy, of course, has existed for hundreds of years, literally like... And you do strategy. We all do strategy in different ways. And it's one of these terms that's like super... means nothing. It's like innovation, but so is design, right? Mm-hmm. Like design is an overused concept, and And there's like capital design, capital D design, lowercase d design. Sure. And yeah, I mean, I think about my work. I think about strategies really kind of connecting things that seem disparate. You know, seeing patterns where they might not normally exist, finding rationale for really complex problems. That's kind of how I define it. I play a lot of chess, and chess is a great analogy for what I think strategy is.
Jesse loves chess.
Oh, yeah? All right, cool.
He's been playing, I think, like 8 to 12-year-old Chinatown kids.
Yeah, I play those.
Usually winning, I think. Yeah.
It's hard.
You know, we have a set right here. We can open it up in a minute.
It's addictive.
When you finished, you said political science in undergrad?
Yeah.
And then what did you do?
I did political science and Africana studies.
Okay.
Which was an interesting combination, right? Africana studies was about Africa and the diaspora of African people and the history and politics and art of that and culture. And political science is really about, you know, politics and power. And so those two together gave me an interesting foundation.
Did you jump from after undergrad straight into a strategy job?
I had been interning at a political consulting company. Mm. And that was fascinating stuff. You know, I was working on like political campaigns around the world. And then while interning at that political consulting company and undergrad, I transitioned immediately into graduate school, which is not something that happens very often now. I think you need to have more work experience. So I was kind of lucky. It was during a different recession too. It was like during the dot-com bust. So it was a natural sort of transition.
Are you still involved with political consulting through Sylvan in any way?
No, I'm not. I mean, I think I'm at a distance. You know, what was interesting is that I was working at this political consulting company and working on political campaigns and increasingly doing more sort of corporate work because companies have political problems. And before I knew it, I was like a company man, you know, and advertising agencies were interested in hiring me. And so in a way, I'm not working on campaigns, but yet I'm using the same skills. I'm doing the same things, thinking about how do you mobilize people and, you know, why do you tap into what they need and give them what they want and really make the most out of what companies do.
Had you seen, cause,
Can I add one
quick
thing?
Please.
Do you know what a B Corporation is, or a certified B Corporation? Of course you do. So we just became a certified B Corporation a few months ago, and that was another attempt to sort of bring that, kind of the political instincts with the corporate instincts and make them all kind of happily coexist more.
And maybe related to that, do you see a transformation or a deliberate addition or growth in the, not the kind of work you're doing, but actually the kind of clients and collaborators that you're trying to work with?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, you know, because we are now at a point where we can be a little bit more choiceful. Mm-hmm. You know, for the first many years, it was desperate. And if I told you the things that we worked on, you'd lose a lot of respect for me. actually,
we have time.
No, it was actually nothing that bad. But it was, you know, a lot of things that we just did because they were there. Now, I think we're definitely looking for clients and projects that have more of a, that tap into that mission about leveraging corporations for the greater good. So, you know, in the case of BlackRock, they have a bit more of a social purpose. You'd be surprised to learn, you know, the WNBA and their mission, you know, ways and their point of view on civic engagement, and human mobility. So, I think that's increasingly where we're directed. You know, clients that aren't clear about that or articulate, like, what is their role in this kind of collective mix are probably not best for us.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how do you, especially now that you have an ability to be more discerning, to kind of make your choices about who to work with, how do you go about clarifying whether, you know, because I'm sure every company, I think, can say they want to be, have more social impact or kind of do something for the greater good, but that may not be the case when they have to commit to it. How do you clarify at the beginning before you kind of sign on or not whether they're
if it's real, you know, it's a lot of it. I wish I could say it's a lot of it is extrinsic. So it's about what I learn about the companies, but it's really more about how we feel about it. Do we feel like it reconciles who we are and who we want to be? You know, we were invited to meet with and this is an extreme example, just to make the point, we're invited to meet with a tobacco company, right? Which is notoriously this industry that some people choose to work on, others don't. And we were not working on that. We would probably never work on that category, but took the meeting because I felt that it was an interesting opportunity to learn, you know, to see the insides of one of these huge companies. You know, they're innovating that space really interesting. They're using technology in really interesting ways in science. And I thought we could learn. And I also was interested about their motivations. Mm-hmm. And I learned a ton. At the end of the day, I chose not to work on it. We all chose not to work on it, but we learned a ton. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, one of the clients in the room who worked for this tobacco company, she lost her father to lung cancer. And she saw this as an opportunity to sort of fix the tobacco industry. And that really shed light to me. Oh, like, the people on that side they're not crazy, mm-hmm. evil people. These are people right. who are just kind of normal humans living their day-to-day life. There's a bit of like judgment that goes into it. But if you're clear, and in my case, I think I am, if I'm clear about the categories and industries and companies that are sort of questionable when it comes to the social good, it makes it easier to kind of decide how and when you work with them. For tobacco is an extreme, but there are others that are in the gray area. You know, we occasionally work with PepsiCo, which, mm-hmm. you know, carbonated soft drinks. I don't give my kid carbonated soft drinks, and it's a troubling category. But they also are doing other things to kind of reinvent that space and looking mm-hmm. at, and they do a lot of public good and stuff. So you have to decide, you know, how do I engage with a company like that and when? I don't like that question. I think it's time consuming to think about what clients are right for us. I'd rather focus on the ones that are, you know, glaringly, obviously right for us.
Right.
You know, when I think a company like BlackRock, despite what you might think, is actually so perfect for us. Or a Google, again, despite what you might think, that a lot of what they're doing is so progressive. And you want to be part of that change. That's where I try to focus, you know, what are the right places to be versus what are the places we don't want to be, you know.
So you grew up born and raised in New York?
Yeah.
Which part of New York?
I grew up in Queens, New York. This little neighborhood called Belrose, New York, which is like far out east and close to Long Island, actually. And it was a really working class neighborhood. It was amazing. And in the 80s, it was kind of an amazing time to be here, as everyone knows.
You still have family out there?
Like extended family, but not a ton. You know, it's my parents are Haitian immigrants and there are Haitians everywhere, you know, in the city.
I think you're probably one of two. I think we've only had two people on the show so far that are native New Yorkers. And even what we were talking about with Claire earlier, do you remember, did you always know that you were going to maybe leave but come back, but really make New York, it was already your home, I guess, but really plant yourself in New York as you kept progressing and growing? Was that always a goal?
For me, I mean, it wasn't a goal. It's just something undeniable part of who I am. And I'm embarrassed to say that, you know, I haven't lived elsewhere for an extended period of time. It's just so viscerally tied to who I am. And I was privileged in that my parents worked for the UN. So we did travel a lot and we got to see a lot of other parts of the world. But New York was so fundamental to how I saw the world and who I am. It's really not about the United States when I say that. It's really about New York.
Mm-hmm.
And it just became obvious. And I can't imagine living elsewhere. Now, with all that said, again, you know, I travel a ton and I have offices around the world and that sort of thing. But, you know, I'm looking at a picture of New York in your office right now. It just feels such a part of who I am. I have a really hard time thinking beyond that. Mm-hmm. I might be close-minded.
I mean, I don't know if there's any more exciting or better is maybe too subjective of a term, but in some ways, like, there's something in New York that doesn't exist anywhere else. Like, I hear you, especially, I was like, I really should have lived in more places, but at this point, it's like, I really like being here. There's no need to force yourself out.
Right. And there's a lot of here, right? You can have many different lives here. You could partake in many different worlds and cultures and tastes here. And also it's sort of a launching pad to many other places too. Mm-hmm. So I can get anywhere in the world. You know, when I think of New York, I don't necessarily think of geography. I think of a mindset, especially from the 80s and 90s, which was about hustle, was about ingenuity, resourcefulness. It was about, you know, common sense, street smart. All of these sort of abstract ideas is what I think make up a New Yorker, and that's what I identify with more than, you know, like I've never been to the Statue of Liberty. You know, I don't really connect necessarily on that level. But, you know, when I walk through Chinatown and I see immigrants making the most of it, leaving something, making a choice to be here and having to be inventive about how to create community here and how do you retain your identity but tap into a new, all of those questions, that to me is New York. And that's why I can feel quite at home here in Chinatown, is because I relate on that level. You know, there's some things that still freak me out. Mm-hmm. But on that level, I'm like, wow, that's totally who I am. Mm-hmm. And where I come from.
What's interesting is there's, I don't want to make a jump yet to the UN connection, but the textures and the details and the all the tangible things that obviously make New York, New York, are really interesting, especially I think compared to when you said, I think especially with the Sylvain Lads projects, that your work and the focus is really on the kind of high level strategy developmental part, really laying the framework for down the road those tangible things to manifest. Have you always known, I mean, even in the when you're in undergrad and maybe before, that your interest was these big picture questions as opposed to, you know, obviously someone else is like, I want to make the skin of that dumpling, or I want to make the tortilla myself.
Yeah, right.
You know, because it's nice to have different guests who lean one way or another, but I love that, or I'm curious kind of where that inkling to actually let me tackle the really big, mm-hmm. amorphous, hard to wrangle issues.
Well, I don't know if it's going to answer your question, but again, I think to be a creative person is a bit of a luxury, right? Professionally. And I never felt that that was attainable because I just didn't have the space or the privilege to do that. And so as a creative person in the world beyond the creative industry, I had to kind of make do and find a home. And that ended up being this thing called strategy. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm more of a kind of creatively minded person. And my craft has become sort of strategy as opposed to design or mm-hmm. whatever it is. And that's by virtue, it's only has to do with the fact that I'm a creative person, I mm-hmm. think. And I'm lucky, you know, there are a lot of creative people who can't find a way to survive being creative. But I think that has a lot to do with the choices that I made, and how, you know, I'm strategy is my job. Mm-hmm. I'm very lucky about that. And it's also just who I am. Like I'd be doing this sort of stuff if I wasn't paid for it, you know?
Mm-hmm. What did your parents do at the UN?
It's actually just my mom worked at the UN. She was like a secretary for a long time and then became sort of a office administration sort mm-hmm. of person.
Did you have or know people growing up that were creative, professionally creative in some way?
No, which is a really good question. And I think this idea of like legacy, or rather the exposure you have to those roles is super, super important. And I really didn't get a sense of, you know, you could be a working creative person.
Yeah.
Like, that's like
that possibility. It was like, that's a thing you can do.
Right. Yeah. And I think we have more of those. You can see that more in New York maybe, but right. I didn't have much of that around me. Not to say that, you know, you can't be creative in everything you do, but yeah, no, the idea of like, I didn't have any working artists or yeah. musicians or let alone business people who worked in creative industries like music or media. I didn't see much of that.
Did you see many kind of entrepreneurial role models around the neighborhood, around the, you know, the world you grew up in?
So not literally, but again, I think in New York, it's there. Yeah. You know, you feel it and you see it. And, you know, the shopkeepers and, you know, this idea of entrepreneur, you know, starting a business didn't feel impossible for whatever reason. And that could be the positive mm-hmm. influence my parents had. It didn't feel insane. And actually as a kid, you know, I did a lot of like fantasy play around mm-hmm. just having my own business. And I think that's has a lot to do with New York again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's funny is I was trying to think, I think you said something earlier, you know, everybody has maybe a small fantasy about starting something. And I'm curious if that was a New York thing. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I certainly, like, I grew up in like a totally anonymous suburb and that was never really, it wasn't that prevalent, that idea of you could be something different. Or in some ways, it wasn't necessarily a pressure, but the idea, I think, of carving something out for yourself in a whole unique way was not at all promoted, or you don't really see that very often. I think it was more the classical, well, you can, you know, you work hard, you can be very successful in whatever job you're in, but it wasn't even really talked about to, no, try to find something on your own, right? And I think that's also why a place like New York is so appealing for so many people, is because everybody there is trying to do something unique in some way. So I know that's what I think of so many special things about New York, and I'm curious if that's, I love hearing that actually, no, that's how you should think. That it should be a way where people can think about that with freedom.
Yeah, I mean, I find that interesting because you did end up doing and behaving very entrepreneurially, and and if not from your childhood, where did that come from?
I don't know. Right. We'll see where the interview goes. I think on Friday we might be talking about it. I hadn't really thought about, because, I mean, a big part of this radio show is also, you know, not having models, certainly models that look like you growing up doing either entrepreneurial stuff, creative stuff, you know, that you could even think about being an artist or a designer in some way and make a living from it. And how do you, whether it's overcome or how do you kind of find your way around it, or how do you do it anyway? I'd never really thought about the feeling like you could start something, or feeling feeling like you could start something kind of way of questioning that. But I think part of it was also, like I said, I've talked to very few New Yorkers, like native New Yorkers, which is actually really exciting to me to actually hear, because of course the context, the environment you grew up in, and the city that you're surrounded by makes such a big difference, I think, in how you understand things.
Yeah, I mean, it's, when you put it that way, it's interesting. You know, the city is sort of, there are these amazing mythologies and narratives about successful entrepreneurs, and most of them are men, for unfortunately, but you know, you can't cross a bridge or see a building and not hear the story of a really visionary person or entrepreneur that put it together. And that, I think that feeds the subconscious of a New York kid to think about what your potential can be. And there are actually a few New Yorkers that stay where they were born and raised. They usually move and they're still in the city maybe, but they're not necessarily going to stay in the same hood and do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you see that, but you do see a lot of migration within the city. But this idea of like seeping into the subconscious that you have work to do and there's something unique about you, I think is profound. And I hate to invoke politics into this because it's not about the politics, but when you hear the story of how Donald Trump was raised and you see how that manifested itself in his name on these big buildings throughout the city and, you know, Fifth Avenue and claiming these like important parts of New York, I think that's a very New York sort of ego-driven thing. The idea that I need to succeed and I want to take over this and I will get a sense of affirmation and validation if I kind of assert that self more. I think that's a little bit of a new, you know, it might be a negative example, but I think that's definitely part of being here. And it's definitely being, you know, having immigrant parents, you definitely feel like you have important work to do.
I was going to say that's another aspect that I find, I'm very curious your take on it, the being Haitian American, right?
That's right.
And also with a number of other guests that are, well, a lot of the guests that are minority American of some sort, that kind of balance of, especially growing up, do I feel American or do I feel Chinese? Do I feel Taiwanese? Do I feel whatever it is? And I'm curious if in New York, was there ever that concern that I wasn't American enough in a place like New York?
Well, I think New York is in itself not American, right? So is that whole question. But I think you're getting at the experience of the other in general, right? So how much, whether you're you know, a man or woman, or born here or not born here, or whatever, left-handed, right-handed, or whatever it is. But this idea of like, how much of my identity is who I am versus the environment that I'm in, and how much of it is about my legacy versus where I want to be. And I think those are, in a way, kind of superficial constructs. And my parents, certainly working at the UN and stuff, they encourage this more, a broader perspective on what identity is. But yeah, I think that's a interesting thing to negotiate for all kids in New York. And I see that happening with my own kids. I see that happening I saw that happening when I was growing up, which was, you know, how much of this land is mine. And now what's amazing about New York is just how much it changes. You know, I had a really interesting experience a couple of years ago where I met this guy who was 40 years older than me. He was much older than me, who he heard I was from Queens, and he was like, "Where are you from in Queens?" And I told him, and he was like, "Oh my God, I'm from the same place in Queens, but I grew up there 40 years before you." And we had this amazing experience to go there together. And
really?
We went out there. He was like in his season 80s now. And he was like Eastern European and Jewish. And he talked about how that's where immigrants came and try to claim a new life. And
like that neighborhood.
That specific neighborhood. Right. It was actually not where I was from. It was where I went to church and where I spent a lot of time. It was in Jamaica, Queens. And I knew it well because that's where I went to school and stuff. And he was like, that's where, you know, poor immigrants would come and start a new life, you know, in the 50s and 60s. I knew that same area as where poor immigrants would come and create a new life, but in the 80s and 90s.
It's amazing.
And literally, you know, I'm not a religious person or anything like that, but I grew up going to church. And we went to this church where he too went as a kid. And it was also a community sort of thing. And we compared notes decades apart. And it was very similar. There's so many other interesting things to tell about that story too, because he's white. But as part of the white flight out of the city, you know, it now is like a Caribbean neighborhood, a black Caribbean neighborhood. And so this idea of like people moving, but the problems being the same or the needs being the same, I think is really interesting.
Is that, because I guess we're actually almost 40 years again from the 80s.
Yeah.
Is that neighborhood still plays that role?
Largely, but you know, Central American populations are coming in a really interesting way, influencing some of those communities. You see that uptown, you see that in Queens. South Asian populations are coming and changing the landscape. So yeah, I do think there's a turning of the page happening in terms of immigrant migration in New York.
When you were growing up there, did you, because I think one of the guests tomorrow was saying one of the formative things, I don't want to blow up, actually I won't say it because I don't want to blow up his, because that's going to be a good story. Point being, did you get out of the neighborhood much growing up? Like, did you see other parts of New York very often?
No, I didn't. Huh. Which again is part of the kind of the short-sighted, you know. And I think we were talking about this a little bit before. It's like immigrants come out of survival; they find each other, and they create these communities, and it stays homogenous, and they don't venture out often. And that was certainly the case in my. We didn't venture out a lot. You know, I didn't go out. I grew up in Queens. I didn't go to Brooklyn at the time, you know? And that had a lot to do with sort of this homogenous, this maybe provincial perspective, where you kept, who you knew and everything stayed really close. What was cool is going to the UN school growing up where I told you, I sent my kids. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, you enter the UN school and you had a perspective all over the world. So I never really felt close-minded in New York, but I think that's possible for sure.
Well, I think I can imagine that being exposed to the UN and the UN school so young, because for a lot of people, I think the moment of going to college is maybe the first time they've left their hometown or suddenly seen so many different types of people. But I guess you started young with that, with the school. Mm-hmm. It's funny because it's incredible and I can't relate at all. Like, it's amazing. Like, I can only relate from college point, but not growing up knowing that. And it seems like such an amazing thing to be able to grow up with and now to be able to send your kids to grow up with. Can you talk about that school? Like, what?
Sure.
How big is it? Like, how many students
are there? It's like 1,300 students. Right now, about half are families that are tied to UN or diplomacy or international relations in some way. And the other half are just regular, you know, New York private school families. And so my mom worked at the UN. My wife also went there and her dad worked for the UN. And there's like a thing there, you know, everyone's got a name that's, you know, hard to pronounce and confusing. You know, everyone has like a cultural sort of background that's unique. At the time, at my time, it was very kind of one-dimensional. You know, I was like the Haitian American kid. Now you see some really interesting mixes amongst kids, like you see in my own. But it was a profound experience because you know, long before the sushi craze in the U.S., there were like Japanese kids who were eating sushi for lunch. That's what they eat for lunch, right? And there were everyone brought their world to that table, and it was amazing. Not only amongst the student body, you know, if I told you where my best friends from high school were from, you'd think it was a joke or a Benetton ad or something like that. But really, we were all from all over the place. But what was amazing was the faculty. And having, and you were getting at this before, like having role models that were reflected an array of backgrounds was profound. You know, I learned French from, I don't think I ever took French from a French person. You know, I learned French from an Algerian person and from a person from Senegal and Vietnam. You know, French, the language, was actually all over the world. And to see those different teachers was pretty cool. And now, you know, the diaspora of that school is unbelievable. You know, I don't have any, I'm the only one amongst my friends that stayed in New York. Everyone else went elsewhere around the world.
Did most of them end up going back to their countries of origin or kind of everywhere else?
Some did. It's really, really mixed. Really mixed. And some just, you know, moved elsewhere. And there was a sort of a adaptability you learned in that school that made it easy to move around. Of course, I didn't, but yeah, I mean, one of my best friends lives in Dallas, Texas, and is a real estate, like works in real estate. Another best friend of mine was in London, and her father was the ambassador to Malaysia. And another friend, you know, is a professor here in New York. And it's just a really varied mix. But I don't know. I'm always very careful to hold up my United Nations experience as exceptional, because somehow I think it makes a judgment about other people's experience, which might be more homogenous or suburban or whatever it is. And I think there's a lot to learn from those as well. You know, I only know mine, and I could tell you mine armed me with advantages. So things like, you know, I probably have exposure to different cultures and languages in a way that makes me quite adaptable around the world. Maybe not in the United States as much. You know, I don't feel as safe in the United States. I don't feel as knowledgeable about the United States. So I think there's strengths and weaknesses. I just want to be clear about that, because it can come across as...
No, true. What I love about it, though, is like, what I think is important maybe also is that you know, obviously that everybody has a totally different story growing up and kind of different experiences growing up. And I think yours is one that seems the most exposure to most diversity very early on. And without even, you know, not necessarily judging for or against it, I guess with this show, I'm always fascinated with how does that affect what you end up doing, basically?
Right. Yes.
The pursuits you have, let alone your kind of thoughts about what you're able to do or not. Because everybody, I think what's nice about everybody on the show is for whatever, wherever they grew up, however they grew up, they found a way to convince themselves that they could do something exceptional. Which is so beautiful, I think, about every guest here. So I think getting back, especially to what you're doing today, I think you mentioned something at I forgot what word you used, but there was something about the adaptability. That there wasn't really a limit, certainly in the types of people that you were around. And I'm curious if there was always a feeling that there wasn't a limit in terms of not only what you could do, but even what a job meant. If that was ever prevalent to you, where like, oh, I don't have to choose a lane necessarily. I don't have to be... Because I think there's one thing to be like, oh, I can be anything I want. But then there's a whole other thing to be like, actually, there might be 500 professions, but the thing I want to do is none of that or a combination of 50 different things. And I only bring this up, and I apologize if it's a little too linear.
No, that's cool.
But when you describe what you do with strategy, it does sound very open-ended in this in a really kind of amazing way, that you can evolve. You're constantly evolving. I can imagine what your job is.
Yeah, and that's the reason it's my job, right? It's because it's not one thing. And what I do over the course of a day is very different. You know, I'm working on spreadsheets, and I'm also writing prose, and I'm presenting, and I'm listening, you know, it's a huge variety of things. And that might be the reason it's for me, you know, because it allows me to be creative and disciplined all at the same time. But going back to, you know, what I think there's something around, being learned as sort of empathy subconsciously growing up, you know, when you're in a truly diverse environment where you know everyone has their own story and you know that's inherent to the human existence, that no two people are the same and that everyone truly has a different perspective, and it becomes easier to channel that experience, I think, and that sort of empathy lends itself really well to the work that I do. And I find that people that do this work have that more. And empathy is like a buzzword or whatever, but they, you know, they can, and certainly in design and in architecture and urban planning, you need to really think about how people are going to interact with the spaces around them. And I think I didn't learn that in school. I think I learned that in the places and ways that we've been talking about.
So one question, what time is it? Oh, pretty good. One question that actually we've been asking everybody, which I always think is usually leads to a funny answer, is where you made your first dollar. And originally it was actually set up to be, where did you make your first, basically who was your first client or collaborator as your business? But I also find it interesting, like, even when was the first time you made a dollar on your own?
On the streets, yeah. The hard streets of Queens. Not at all, actually. I was a soccer referee.
Really?
Yeah. No, I was young.
That's amazing.
It was super fun for kids. You know, I was like 15 or something.
That's awesome.
It was super fun. I wish there was a better story, but that's all it was.
That's rad. Do you still ref soccer now? Like, do your kids play soccer?
My kids play. I coached for a number of years, yeah, but they're not into it anymore.
Okay.
But yeah, the first dollar is a really good. In fact, isn't the first dollar like a truly symbolic thing for all small businesses?
They
frame the first dollar.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, for us, I mean, I have a picture of our first check at Sylvain Labs from AOL, the thriving tech company you may have heard of. And they needed help 9 years ago, and they still need help. But,
Was that who the client that when you transitioned the next day into Sylvain Labs? That was
exactly. I had I kind of secured them as a client, and they gave us this project, which now looking back isn't that big. It's kind of like whatever, but at the time it was massive, and actually was big enough to sort of capitalize the company in those early days,
awesome.
And free us up to think about other things and create other opportunities. But yeah, I mean, I think very fondly about that first check and that first dollar, and a little bit nostalgically. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I wonder if you feel this way, because I look back at the first dollar as a time when I was impassioned about what I do, and I was desperate, and so that those pennies were hugely valuable to me, much more than what we get now.
Yeah, I remember there's definitely something that I still hold with, you know, when you're trying to, especially in a creative field, trying to figure out what a value of your work is, like, you know, you're valuable, you know, and you tell yourself that, but putting a dollar figure to that is not always the easiest thing to do psychologically anyway.
Right.
And so I feel like that first dollar or set of dollars that comes in, almost no matter the amount, you're like, oh shit, someone's paying me to do what I love to do anyway.
Right.
And I remember, actually I have to think about what this dollar question is for us, but I'm sure the amount was much smaller than we charge now, obviously, I hope. but also thinking, this is so much money for what I'm doing.
Yeah.
In a way that almost felt unfair.
Yeah.
Like, did I just right. do something secretive? Did I do something that is not allowed? Like, this is so crazy that there's an opportunity here to keep doing this for money.
I can relate to that so much. You know, what I tell myself is that there isn't an objective kind of currency. Like, the value you put on a dollar is different than the value your clients put on a dollar. Mm-hmm. And for them, it's worth every penny. But for you, that work, you know, maybe isn't. And maybe that's what business is, mm-hmm. right? It's like you see the delta between how easy it is for you to do something versus how much someone will pay
right.
for it. But yeah, I mean, I go through that same experience all the time. Like, we're getting paid for this.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes we get projects like, what is the future of blank? Like, really big questions. Mm-hmm. Like, what is the future of health? Yeah. What's the future of personalization? Right. Like, how will people personalize things in the future? And these really abstract questions, and here's 4 weeks. Huh. We'll think hard about it, and we'll give you our perspective of what we think the future will be. And it's like, what? Huh? Clients will pay for this? And, you know, is this really valuable?
Right.
You know, at the end of the day, like, is it valuable? And the thing is, like, it's valuable to those companies in those circumstances, mm-hmm. who don't have that space and time and maybe capability to explore that. And that's how I view money, mm-hmm. is it's the value is really relative to where it's coming from, right. and who's willing to pay for it. And then when I figured that out, it made it easier to make money, mm-hmm. you know, to find what unique things we could bring to companies that were in need, and like, mm-hmm. what were their unique needs and stuff.
Yeah, do you, whenever the fee was settled with the AOL project, do you remember what that feeling was? Was it like, they just signed off on that, or was
it? No, it was relief. Oh, cool. You know, it's funny. I'm not struck by that same thing that you were talking about. For me, it's because I'm more self-centered than you, but I was like, oh, cool, they're paying for this. All right,
cool.
I can do what I want to do.
Yeah, nice.
But over the years, as I kind of have fine-tuned what I want to do, and I've had more space to kind of create what I want to do, that's when we're committed to this new mission about leveraging the might of corporations for the greater good. Mm. And that's, you know, now we're starting to take that as a responsibility. Where in the AOL days, it was more of like a opportunity for us. Mm-hmm. Now we see it as like a responsibility for everyone.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Well, thanks for being on the show and for the time and for the work you do. Thanks for joining Plus Wool.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. And thanks for doing this. It's super cool. It's such an important part of the city, and what you're doing is fantastic.
Thank you. Yeah, I think just even conversations with people that were from New York, I think that alone is always hugely exciting, because it's even when the group of people I know and work with and friends, it's still a rarity. There's so many different types of people in New York from different places that every once in a while, when you come across someone that's from New York, it's like there's such a different, amazing perspective on stuff that's always good to tap into. So appreciate the sharing that.
Cool.
All right.